This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. This week's episode is brought to you again by the Friends of the Magic Word. I have to say that because I have been traveling so much here recently and just been posting a barrage of podcasts, I've not had a chance really to thank a lot of people who have joined the Friends of the Magic Word and pledged their support or given a one-time donation or perhaps have increased their pledges. I want to thank all of you, and in particular the newest people who have just joined. I wanted to thank and welcome Rob Fisher, and Barry Seeley, who also goes by Baz, Baz Seeley, Adam Turner, Stephanie Beach, Ryan Johnson, and Carl Peffer. Thank you guys very much. I appreciate you joining. Thanks for listening, and thanks for helping to support this podcast so that everyone else in the world can enjoy this then as well. And if you're interested in learning how that you can become a friend of the Magic Word and get some pretty cool perks along the way, then be sure to go to themagicwordpodcast.com, and there you'll see a link that will say that you can become a friend, and you can watch the video and learn more about what you can do to give us a little bit of financial assistance. And we thank all of you who have assisted in the past over the years, and also look forward to having you as a friend of the Magic Word. Well, this week we're actually going to be presenting something a little bit different. I say that because I have several conversations that I've recorded over the past couple of months that are kind of in queue that I want to release, but because of the immediacy, I guess, of this, that is that the Magic Live convention was just this last week in Las Vegas, and here in 2019, and it was just phenomenal. Great time was had by all 1,600 registrants, but we also had a lot of outstanding speakers, and they were all inspirational. I mean, not just the performances and everything else, but also the speakers in the general sessions. The focus sessions were great. The first person who kicked off the general session was a gentleman who actually started off, I guess he was a magician. He was a member of the Junior's Magician at the Magic Castle. He talks a little bit about that here on the podcast. But he was also, more importantly, perhaps better known as being the chief strategist and vice president of Adobe, where he was the one responsible for Photoshop and for PDFs. Yeah, I mean, somebody had to come up with that idea, and it was him and his department that developed that and produced it and has that available to the world. I think that's kind of cool. Well, what he continued to go on and do is to teach other people how to be innovators. And so what he talked about in the context of the short amount of time he was given during the general session was how that we as magicians can create things. And in particular, he was talking about how that you can take some coins, some dice, and some cards, and some sticky notes you put on there, and essentially you can change the dynamics of how that you would create. And I would encourage you, after you've listened to this podcast, if you're interested in learning how to be more creative, this is a great innovation, I think, in which that you can go to themagicwordpodcast.com, and there you will see some of the pictures that I had taken at the event at the general session, that you can see what the coins look like and also all the words that he had suggested that you can put on the dice and the cards and on the coins. And so this way that you can make up your own trick box, if you will. What he had done is come up with a thing called Kickbox. Well, I'm kind of really getting ahead of myself. This gentleman, again, is someone who is never seen performing or lecturing or even attending magic conventions very often, if at all. And it's doubtful that he will ever return necessarily, because it's just he has pulled in so many directions all over the world where people are wanting to learn from him. And I had really intended just to kind of sit down with him and talk for a few moments about the what his discussion was about, if he could just kind of give a quick overview. And you will find in this podcast, actually, that he went on for a lot longer, which is why that I have him then as a featured guest in this particular podcast. And in fact, that you're going to hear a lot more from me now on the front end of this than you will hear during this podcast. I know a lot of you are saying, thank goodness, I get to hear enough of that guy's voice. I don't want to hear any more of Scotty. I want to hear his guest. Well, that's exactly what I do. I really kind of sit back at the feet of this giant who is giving us some to wonderful pearls of wisdom and suggestions on how that we can create and make our own magic much more strong with by creating our own stuff that is uniquely you or mine. So anyhow, a lot of really great stuff. I think that you're going to enjoy this, where he's talking about creativity and art, and it's truly an inspirational podcast. So please welcome my guest this week, Mr. Mark Randall, here on The Magic Word. All right, Scott Wells for TheMagicWordPodcast.com, and one of the people who was a standout from yesterday's general session that you've heard people say about how much that they've enjoyed the people who were in the general session, but the one that they were talking about the most was Mark Randall, and he's with me here then right now. So hello, Mark.
Hello.
So glad that you're here with me then as well. And so your background, we were talking about sound and light and everything, so you know a lot about sound and light and everything. I mean, when you're working with Photoshop, I guess, and so how'd you come about knowing about that?
Well, yeah, actually, I got into technology and became a technology startup entrepreneur, and the things that I worked on inventing and developing and based my startups around were video technologies and audio technologies, and so I actually have 2 Primetime Emmy Awards for technical achievement.
Wow.
And not for magic or anything else, for inventing products like the first desktop video product, the first video blogging product, and so I actually created technology that was used to create 800 shots in Star Wars Phantom Menace. I worked at the ranch with George Lucas, for in the capacity of my startup and creating new technologies, and did a lot of stuff that was used in a lot of film, a lot of television, and been on a lot of movie sets, and then working with my customers during the startup era. So it was very exciting, and I also did consumer products that sold millions, that were sold in Best Buy, and Walmart. Marts around the world, and just technology products that people would buy for their computers, and that was fabulous. And then my third startup that I had founded, and I was the CEO, but also the kind of chief product officer of the company, sort of doing the product designs, was acquired by Adobe.
Okay.
And so I sold my company to Adobe, and that's how I ended up at Adobe, where I was chief strategist and VP of creativity, which was a pretty fun job because it's arguably the most creative company in the world, doing tools for artists, designers, Hollywood, and so we have a huge toy box of technologies, and it was a lot of fun. So I only planned to stay a few years after the acquisition, the typical startup entrepreneur, MO, to vanish into the night after 24 months, and the 24 months came, and that happens usually because there's a significant retention, if you stay, you get more.
More money,
Because we want to buy your time for 2 years. And then that day came and went, and things were working out, and I ended up staying actually for 12 years. I just retired. So now I can finally get back to, I stopped performing as a professional magician, working as a magician, and really being very involved in the world of magic when I was 20 years old. And so now in my early 50s, I can get back onto my main career after this whole detour into technology.
Kind of back to a passion of magic. Didn't you say that you were a member of the junior?
Yes, I was a junior member, and I was also a converted to a regular member, although I wasn't really at the time I turned 21. Because when you're under 21 at the castle, they created in the 70s a private group, and just called the juniors, and you could only come on some, because it's over 21 club.
Was that Diana Zimmerman and everybody back
Diana
then?
Zimmerman and Vernon and a bunch of, we had amazing, Goshman and other people teaching us. We were learning from giants. And so when I was 15, I auditioned, and I got in on my first audition. And that was surprising because it was quite difficult to get in. They had quite a high bar because they weren't getting, the dues were $10 a month.
Goodness, yeah, a lot of money back then.
I still have one of the dues checks, that my mom wrote. I said, Mom, I need everything in the old magic boxes in the attic. And she sent me a box. And I have, Max Maven 40-year-old lecture notes that I'm like, Max, I had these lecture notes. And he's like, I don't even remember them. He said, I don't even remember them.
Yeah, you got to say that voice.
And so it was really fun coming back to a magic show and speaking here. It was a great audience. And Stan you know, is actually, this has been in the works for about 6 years, trying every year, asking me to come. And every year I'd like, I think I could do it in August. And then about in May, I would have to like, I'm sorry, I'm going to,
something came up.
I'm going to be in Tokyo that week. Or I'm going to be in, you know, and it just couldn't.
But you're retired,
it.
Man.
I, finally, when I, he's like, all right, I saw the press release. It says you're retiring in a few months. So now you have no excuse. And he, you know, I'm trying to do less. I've turned down probably, you know, a ton of conferences and other things to do so I can do more of the things I want to do that I retired to do. And
well, that was one of the things he was saying. You're probably going to be offered these opportunities, quote, using air quotes there, to come and work at other magic conventions. But, you know, this is just a one-off that you probably are never going
to
be.
This is just a favor to Stan as a friend. Yeah. He was a Long Beach mystic. Yeah. I was a Magic Castle junior. It's like the Crips and Bloods, you know.
I was going to say, as far as, just real quickly, and then we'll move on. Who were some of the people, do you recall, who were
oh, so the
juniors?
My generation.
In your juniors?
Yeah, in the juniors. It was J. Scott Berry. I'm trying to think. Mark Kalin. And
well, these are some of the guys who were in the Long Beach Mystics, though, too.
Some of them were crossovers, splitters. Okay. They were in both. But that was my generation. And I was a close-up person. So, you know, of course, we knew stage and parlor. We had to learn stage and parlor. Yeah. One of the great things is they would, a lot of these old vaudeville guys, Vernon and other people, had these experience. When we would do stage shows with all the stage performers of the juniors, they made the close-up guys do emceeing and all that other. Like, you're going to learn stage presence even if you're just, you know, even if you don't have any boxes or birds, you know. No boxes, no birds. All right, you're the MC.
Yeah, they find something for you to do then.
Right.
Yeah, we could spend a lot of time in talking all about this. Your time is valuable, I know, and I just want to talk a little bit again because that this was something yesterday that everybody was saying, myself included, one of the highlights so far to the convention. We don't know what's going to be happening the rest of the time, but, you know, that the way that you are have created things out of the box, you created the box, actually, I guess the trick box, kick box, then for people to actually start using their imagination and to start creating. And I was talking a little bit this morning with Jade, who had gone to Tom Stone's College of Creativity. I guess he had something he was had in Sweden, and she had flown over, you know, just to take this like a 7-day conference. And so, you know, she was interested also in what you had to say, you know, on this, on creativity. So anyhow, for the listeners, if you can kind of given a synopsis over here, kind of what your philosophy is and how that you suggest people create.
Well, Stan and I spent a little bit of time talking about what I could share. And so my career at Adobe was interesting because when I started, I'll start kind of with that background and then how it plays directly into what I talked about yesterday and the tools that I released yesterday for the community. Because my one requirement for Stan was, and the reason I kept turning down doing the conference, he's like, well, I think you'd be really interesting. You're a good speaker. And I said, look, I just want to, I don't want to name check Adobe and all of that, you know, and I do so many industry conferences and TED main stage and all, like, I don't want to do, you know, I don't need to do another conference. So thanks, but no thanks. I don't want to do it unless I can be profoundly useful to the audience. And I'm not sure I can be, you know, I went to a lot of magic conventions in my youth, and there are some speakers that were awesome and great and others that, you know, it was not that great. Right. And not that great maybe for anyone in the audience except for themselves. And so I didn't want to be that person.
Yeah.
And so I had kind of set this bar, and that was the other reason that I was reluctant. And so then we came up with kind of an angle, which was my work in sort of creativity and innovation, because one of my first assignment at Adobe was we want you to build new businesses as you've done in your own startups successfully and designing new products for Adobe, which I did. And some of them failed miserably and some of them became big successes. But the, and one of my primetime Emmys came not from my startups, but after I was at Adobe, which was unexpected and, for a product. And the interesting thing is that they also brought me in to say, let's do teaching our employees, 22,000 employees around the world, how each one of them could be an innovator. Because I also believe, because they said, why don't you teach others how to innovate? First of all, you know, and I said, well, you have to find the innovators. And they're like, where are they? And I said, I think everyone, all 22,000 people could be innovators.
Mm-hmm.
Because everyone sees something unique at the right moment in time and can be that person.
From a different perspective.
We want to equip them to be a creator. And that's, you know, what I talked about yesterday is the belief that everybody in the magic community can and should be a creator. Whether you share your creations or not, A, it's fun for you. It will deepen your love of magic, I think. You'll have a lot of fun doing it, even if you never share. Like, I often joke around, like, some things I just do for me, you know?
Yeah.
And you should do some things just for you.
Yeah.
And then there are other things, some of those things that you do just for you, that's like, well, I liked it, maybe nobody else did, will other people will love. And so my talk was really about work that I did at Adobe teaching others. I had to go figure out and be introspective about my process as an entrepreneur, building companies, new technology products. And what I did in my startup, so my third startup that Adobe bought, I named Serious Magic. Mm-hmm. It was actually the company, and we created a lot of video technology, as I talked about. We did no magic, actual magic. Nobody for my decades-long career in technology knew that I did magic. I didn't perform magic on the side or even for fun or show people. I was just, like, not going to do that because I was, you know, very focused on what I was doing at the time. But I use magic theory in creativity to invent products all the time. So even, you know, like the Fitzky book written before I was born, mm-hmm. you know, Trick Brain.
Magic and Showmanship. Oh, Trick Brain.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, Trick Brain, you know, was when I got into the castle at, you know, 15, I read that in the library and it absolutely blew my mind because I was finally thinking about, you know, methods and effects. And I actually teach. So eventually at Adobe, I figured out how to teach other people how to do this, and it became very successful. And we had huge innovations that Adobe, since I joined the company, and certainly not because of me, but has grown about 1,000%. And this part of this enormous success is the transition that we did, and a lot of that was involving everybody in the company in creating new things, and mm-hmm. not just a small set of inventors or programmers or engineers.
So every employee is an innovator, basically.
Every employee, yeah. Employee badge, the general employee badge everybody wears on their belt, we call the innovator's license at Adobe.
That's cool.
And I would say, you have an innovator's license. It looks like this. It's a thing on your belt every day,
huh.
And it's your job. And if you have an idea, you are the CEO of that idea.
So you're empowering everybody.
Empowering mm-hmm. everybody. And in fact, we, you know, the basis of the program that I did is Adobe will, and every employee, Adobe will fund any idea that you have that you want to pursue for the company before you tell it to us. We will teach you how to do it, but no manager will review it. You decide. And so we're going to fund it, not for millions of dollars, but we'll give you initial funding in a process where you can develop that idea and test it out with some customers, and you guide the process until you like it enough, and then you want to pitch management.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not going to put an initial filter, because what I learned was that initial filter blocks a lot of great ideas. And the reason some startups are so successful and big companies aren't is because managers are hired to manage, mm-hmm. and they can't, you know, identify new things.
That's a good point.
And entrepreneurs, you know, everybody at Adobe
right brain,
knows how to take a product from, you know, $10 million product to $1 billion product, but they don't know how to take something from $0 to $1 million, zero to existence.
Mm-hmm.
So we call it zero to 1.0. It's a completely different skill set than 1.0 to 1.1, mm-hmm. et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, which I would be lousy at, but I'm very good at zero to one. And so that, all of that sort of process that I started teaching, and so I would do these workshops to train people. They come to a two-day workshop, all the employees, I train them one at a time, travel the world to do it, and I taught them how to have new ideas, how to identify the good ones by combining the bad ones, polishing them. I gave them frameworks for divergent thinking. Like, I had to figure this out, and then teach them how to test their ideas, develop them, and then make them successful and mm-hmm. communicate it to other people. And that became a hit and became successful. And this crazy idea of funding their ideas before they had them ended up being a sensation, as weird as it sounds. So other companies heard about it and started calling, like big Silicon Valley companies, and your Apples and Googles, like, you can't
right.
possibly be doing this. And like, yes, it sounds so weird. How could this? Anarchy, you know. I'm like, yeah, but you know, the dirty secret is innovation in big companies doesn't work very well, and they're terrified about it. They spend huge amounts of money for most of these things that don't ever pan out and get canceled before they ship. And so it's this dirty, dark secret that doesn't work. And I had something that actually worked. It's crazy. It was the least crazy thing that I tried that worked.
Interesting.
And so and I tried a lot of other things that didn't work over a period of years until I tried crazier and crazier until I got to that. And so that started working as a process. I labeled it Kickbox. It actually comes in a box. And what I showed yesterday was, you know, the box is kind of like getting, you know, people are like, ask me in technology, where did you get the idea of putting your innovation kit in this red box or whatever? And I was like, showed a picture of a
Misto Magic Kit.
Misto Magic Kit. It was under the Christmas tree. And I'm like, here's how you expose people to a new thing, give them new skills, and teach them. You give them the starter kit.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the innovator starter kit. It's kind of based on a Misto Magic Kit. And I don't, you know, I would tell that to people, but it doesn't have magic.
It doesn't
in
resonate
it.
Unless that they actually were
a magician,
that path
right?
Themselves.
And so I finally had an audience that would get that joke and why it was so fun. And so, but that's really where the idea came from. But a lot of the creation is sort of this, like in technology, we talk about there are a lot of solutions in search of a problem. Mm-hmm. Like an engineer says, we have this neat technology.
Yeah,
let's find a way to make it. And a customer doesn't care about a product; they want it to solve a problem for them. And so and that's often magicians going around that they have an awesome method and they're looking for an effect. And so those two things are very analogous. And I would actually explain the creative process that magical creators, not that performers. First of all, I would explain that the magicians that you see on stage do the stuff that are your Copperfields and Burtons and famous magicians, oftentimes aren't the inventors that invent the concepts that drive them. They're often the packagers, hires managers. I mean, they're brilliant at those things, brilliant business people and performers, but they, and that's a whole different skill set, but the sort of conceiving the new thing and how it should work is very much kind of an engineering task, and not always just engineering and a mechanical engineering, but engineering perception. Mm-hmm. And it's how to think impossible things and turn them into the possible. So one of the things I talk about is, you know, the great story that David Copperfield tells about when they did the Statue of Liberty disappearing, that the initial idea for that effect, because they just were dreaming great effects and then work backward to the method, which was my favorite way of inventing. Just imagine the most incredible and possible thing, and then we'll try to see how close we can get. And then in entrepreneurship, what I would teach is what would be perfect. So what would be the perfect Adobe product? Well, Photoshop's complicated. The perfect Adobe product would be a helmet you put on your head, you close your eyes, imagine the drawing you want on the screen,
and
open your
there.
Eyes, and it's on the screen.
Right.
That would be the ultimate Adobe product,
okay.
right? And, of course, we can't actually do that yet. I've worked with neuroscientists to see how far away is that, and it's on somewhere in the future, our future, not as far as people think. But that product, you know, when it ships, will have an Adobe logo on it, but it will not be for the next decade. And so then I would ask this magical question that I learned to ask in magic, which is, how close can we get?
Okay.
I can't really make the girl disappear. How close can I get? And it turns out that when you're trying to do really hard things that are really valuable for people, you often don't need the entire solution. Big companies tend to offer things that are the complete entire solution. Startups tend to come out with breakthrough new things at an amazing new price or capability.
Right.
But they don't quite do everything perfectly. Right? They just do the one thing you couldn't get. And that was almost the modus operandi of my startup products. They wouldn't do everything the big guys could do, but they do the three things people cared about most for a tenth the price or a hundredth the price, because we did it in a whole new way. And that is often how a magic trick works. Well, you can't really levitate the girl, but how
but
can you do that?
But you have the appearance of
that. Yeah, we have the appearance of that happening, you know, no matter what the method is. And there's a lot of methods, and there are a lot of effects. And so to wrap up on the Copperfield analogy, you know, they the initial idea in the brainstorming session, that's what I heard, was we're going to make the moon disappear. You're going to bounce lasers off of it and do, you know. But then they realized, like, it was, they went and tested it, which is great. Talked to people about it. Like, what would you know, person in the street, what would you think? David Copperfield special, he's going to make the moon disappear. And people didn't, they understood the idea, but they didn't relate to it. It was like too big.
It was too much to swallow, basically.
Yes, it was basically too much to swallow. And so they scaled it down to the biggest magic trick ever, making the Statue of Liberty disappear.
Yeah.
And so that's an interesting, like, what would be perfect, an example of playing that sort of game. And that's how I would come up with a lot of technology products. So it's how to dream up the impossible and then figure out how do we make it possible. And every magic trick has these compromises. Well, it's not angle-proof. It has to be reset. It has to – and new technology products, you know, if anybody's tried a VR headset, you know, it's far from a perfect consumerized product yet.
Right.
But it's like sort of – it's the how close we can get 1.0 version or beta version of what will eventually in 10 years be in everyone's house.
I have been to the South by Southwest conference, you know, and seen the AR and VR in the future, and it's like what we can even do right now and what I can see that the future is going to be, it just gives you goosebumps. I mean, it's phenomenal.
Yeah, but, you know, today it's kind of low res.
Correct.
The frame rate isn't great. It's
but the same way the games, I mean, look at some of the games before.
It costs $1,000, takes hours to set up, and breaks all the time.
We used to just have Pong also, remember?
Right. And now you just plug something in and you get these amazing experiences. So that's the progress of technology, but it always starts kind of broken or barely working. But magic is this way of taking things that don't do what you're what they appear to do and making them appear to do other things. And so that's a thought process. And actually, after my talk yesterday, somebody came up to me and I was walking around and introduced themselves. Hedy was a senior engineer at Intel for 30 years, just retired, who had a reputation for thinking differently, and they would bring him their challenging problems. And he would talk to people at Intel about what he learned from the book The Trick Brings. I mentioned it in my talk, just as an influential, you know, blew my mind kind of thing. And to think about methods and effects and process and a structure for creativity. And so what I did was with Kickbox actually a structure for creativity, where sort of divergent thinking frameworks and all of that that are very practical. I ended up open sourcing it at Adobe because so many people were asking about it, and we decided it's not going to be an Adobe product. It's not our business. We make software and services, and very successfully so. It's a process by which we make software and services. It's not our business, so we'll just give it away. We developed it for us. We use it. It works great. And so we documented it and put it online for free in 2015. Sent out a press release and did zero promotion and really haven't thought about it much. And since then, it's now become the world's most used enterprise innovation process. And so thousands of companies now use it, you know, from MasterCard to Virgin Media to Amazon to the White House uses it. DARPA uses it. The United Nations, the Peace Corps uses it to teach people how to think about innovation, which I never planned with this process that I released. And interestingly, now universities use it. And so, which I never designed it for, but they've adapted it because it's open source. And they all share back in an open community. It's kind of like Linux. And in fact, Adobe ended up contributing the ownership of Kickbox to a nonprofit foundation that's owned by the community. So it's like Linux in that way, but it's an innovation process. So people can go to kickbox.org if they're in the business world and interested in that or want to do a startup and learn about that. And it's a process for doing that. And you can download it all for free. There's nothing to buy. It's not a come on. I don't have a newsletter. I don't want your email. I don't need to know who you are. There's really nothing about, you know, I'm not involved. And but I created it, threw it out there, and despite my benign neglect, it has over things that people were spending millions of dollars trying to market as competing systems, and the one that I created, put out, for and free. Ignored and for free became the one that everybody's using because it works. It's crazy enough to actually work. And so and I ran into people here, from these guys from where they were the largest utility company in Germany, and they were magicians who happened to fly to the conference. They said, our company uses Kickbox. We love it. Wow. I'm gonna, and they wanted to take a picture with me and send it, because they send it to the Kickbox team at Adobe, like, we met the Kickbox guy at a magic conference. And so that was fun. And so weirdly, you know, it, I don't even realize often how widely it's spread. I've been to, you know, I heard about an elementary school that uses it to teach STEM to kids, which is fantastic. And so as I was developing, you know, something that I wanted to do, you know, I could talk about general principles of creativity, but I said, well, let's make this practical. And so I sort of tongue-in-cheek, I have Kickbox. It's this red box that people know in the innovation and business enterprise world. So yesterday I announced Trickbox, which is just a version. It's sort of like a magic creativity kit. And, you know, I mocked it up just to say Trickbox on the cover, no tricks included. So it's the only magic, you know, set you'll get that actually has no effects. It's all methods. And what I mean by methods is it's a way of really doing three things to spark your creativity. And there's a lot of books you can buy about developing concepts and ideas, but where you start at the highest level of the creative funnel is less documented. There's not much information about it because it's really hard and it seems almost a little magical. It comes to you in a dream or whatever. Like, people get very vague and fuzzy. Where does this inspiration come from? Well, turns out that that is just as much of a rigorous process. So when I would, and now I've been, you know, I got flown around the world before I retired, and now I say no a lot to flying around the world to go teach corporate CEOs, how do we do the same thing Adobe did to turn your company around and become 10 times more valuable? With our big company, and they're thinking about it wrong. And the way I learned in the magic world was that you start with the effect, work backward to the method, and always be performing for your audience, which means put the customer first in the business world. And so I kind of back up and I teach them, you know, basic structural process of how to do that in a framework. And so Trickbox does exactly that. It gives you the But I put the randomization element onto dice, so I showed people. I went to the casino gift shop. I bought some dice for a dollar. Mm-hmm. I bought a deck of playing cards for a dollar. And I took five half dollars that I already had, so a total cost of $4.50. And I put this onto slides and pictures, which you could link to.
Right.
And I said, look, here's how you make your dice. You mark them up, and they randomize your thinking. And it's sort of like you hold everything constant but move one thing, like the who, what, when, where, why, and how right. of what your effect is. Or we label the cards with Sharpie, and then you go through, and it's basically you roll the dice, you flip the coins. I call it flip, pick, and roll. You flip a coin, you pick
roll
a card,
the dice.
Or pick a card, and
yeah.
then roll a dice.
Yeah.
And then that gives you this sort of randomized stat to now solve a creative problem fund. Mm-hmm. So you already have a magical problem in mind.
There are hundreds of iterations, obviously, of how that these can
right.
work.
And so I started using that kit, and mm-hmm. I came up with about 15 really good ideas, and then Stan had the terrible challenge of, you know, because I kept refining it till it worked, and all 15 were good. He wanted to do. We could do a session on each one of these 15 great things. You should stop. I just showed one very
yeah.
briefly, but the you know, it kind of worked. And the one was basically I flipped the coin, and one of the dichotomies in the coin thing is. On one side of a coin is the word old, and the other side of the coin is the word new.
Mm-hmm.
And one side of the coin is larger, and one side of the coin is smaller. So it's like, what if we take this thing and we make it bigger? You know, like, okay, so I'm sure, like, Copperfield's famous, you know, the Azra Ferrari, if you remember from his
right,
first TV
sure
special.
Yeah.
You know, that's like, what do we do if we take a Azra of a girl and make it bigger? You flip the bigger coin.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, let's do a car. You know, has anybody saw a car in half? Probably. You know, like, and so it's like, well, it gives you an interesting dimension. And so in the same way, I flipped the coin and I came up with the word old. All right, so you have to start with something that exists now and think, you know, start with sort of in the past. And so I started thinking about what hasn't changed, which is often one of these innovation questions. Everybody said, what's new? AR,
sure.
VR, AI.
Yeah, right.
And sometimes the biggest businesses are built around answering the question, what hasn't changed? And in fact, so much of innovation is really about getting the right question. People say, what do you do at Adobe? And I'm like, well, we have a lot of people much smarter than me that answer questions. So really my job is to come up with the right question. And that is turns out to be remarkably hard. And so the question was, black art. Why hasn't black art, the idea of stage magic back in the day of kerosene lanterns on the stage, they would put black velvet and have a dark stage. Stages were dark anyway. They didn't mm-hmm. have electrified lighting in most theaters. And so I remember reading in Dunninger's, you know, seeing those drawings of black art and somebody under a cloak, you know, hiding, and you couldn't see them because they were under a black cloth.
Right.
And then that went by the wayside and is rarely used in magic today. I don't know anybody that does a big stage show with it except maybe Blackstone. You know,
well, there have been a couple people, I think, overseas. Many years ago, Dublin Foss, I think, and there was another fellow who has like a Sultan thing where he cuts off a head and the head floats or something. You know, there are some things. And I've seen also on America's Got Talent, there have been people
yeah.
using black art as well.
And so I think black art was interesting, but so it was sort of, you know, old. So that was an interesting old thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then smaller. So I got from, you know, bigger versus smaller. All right, I'm going to take something small. How do we do black art and make it small? So nobody's ever done black art in close-up because close-ups typically,
Chin
except
lamp.
Since seance rooms, well, at least mm-hmm. that I knew of. Remember,
okay.
I haven't been involved in magic much
right.
for about 30 years. But
mm-hmm.
anything like starting 30 years ago, I have an encyclopedic knowledge of, and then nothing since
yeah,
then.
For a period.
And so the interesting thing to me is, like, you know, I was not aware. I'm sure people, world's a big place. There is no new ideas. It's the other thing I teach. But you sort of modify and try to find out what other people have done. And in fact, I worry if I come up with a thought and I go online and I can't find at least someone that had this idea, then it's probably not a good idea. Like, you know, I don't want ideas that somebody else didn't have at least a little. Other people are like, oh, I'm looking for an idea no one ever had. And then they discover that someone had it. And then they're like, oh. And I'm like, oh, no, you have it exactly backward.
Yeah.
And so I'm delighted to hear that people tried it in close-up, but there's the obvious challenges of the lighting and all of that. And so I was thinking, all right, well, that put me in an interesting ballpark I never thought about. And so then I rolled the dice and sort of and used the cards. And the cards, the suits, I think it's clubs, six of clubs was the card I drew. And the clubs are really talking about methods. And I'm sorry, the clubs are talking about categories like science, physics, you know, like, what am I going to apply as a category? History, geology, could be in storytelling, like, it's sort of 13 categories, and number six is materials. So what about in materials can we do to change or alter the materials? And so you could think futuristic material science, or you could think, how do we do this in old brocade fabrics? Or, you know, like, sure. Could we do a dye box in fabric? Can we do a, you know, like, whatever the creative, like, you know, poses interesting questions. And the Hearts suit is 13 great performers, you know, starting with Vernon. And it's like, because I would often ask myself, because Vernon was one of my mentors at the castle. I was very fortunate to have, you know, Di Vernon sit in the back row in the close-up gallery, and I'm doing my favorite winged silver coins across. And I hear from the back row, you palm like a little girl, you know, and I'm 16 years old. But I, you know, I learned so much from him and other people. And so I asked, like, what would Vernon do? Uh-huh. And it's not always like you would have the right answer, but anyone you could model. I asked Penn Jillette, it's a friend, like, from way back, and what would Penn do, you know, and what would, you know, but I also have on there, like, what would Dante do? What would, you know, Robert Houdin do in the 1800s? What would Merlin do from the fictional character from the 1300s? And right. So it's those are interesting questions. And so I kind of ended up with four cards of four different suits. You take one from each suit randomly. And that sort of put me in the ballpark of thinking about close-up black art and thinking about materials. And so I started researching, well, what are the blackest blacks? It turns out there's some new metamaterials that have just been discovered in laboratories and stuff that just happened on Kickstarter in recent months that I'd never heard about until I did a Google search. And then 4 minutes after pulling a card, I now knew about a new paint called Super Black 3.0.
Okay.
That's one of the blackest blacks that's ever been created. It has carbon nanotubes in it that absorb light.
Oh, amazing.
And so I showed a video clip YouTube that I found after randomly pulling these cards, putting in a Google search, and now I'm discovering something.
You showed the different kinds of blacks and everything.
I found new solutions to a problem that had never occurred to me 4 minutes earlier.
Yeah.
Right?
Wow.
Answers to a question, potential answers to a question that had never occurred to me.
Yeah.
And I showed in the video, and it's amazing, people go online and look up the Super Black or Vanta Black or these other things and just watch the, they're doing the stuff. They take a dimensional object in normal, like, room light, and it looks like a black void. You can't see the shape of it because no parts of it are, it just sucks the light in like a sponge.
Right.
And so these paints have certain requirements, but, you know, the cheaper ones are like $30 a tube. They just started selling it a few months ago. I put an order in and just to play with. And I'm sure it'll have limitations and other things, but it's like, could that be an interesting close-up thing where at the right moment in a close-up routine, you actually could do something with black art that wouldn't have been possible before? And so that, you know, was sort of just one example that I, you know, was throwing out. There were a bunch of other really interesting ones. And so one of the dyes is... one of them is who, what, when, why, where, how, but the other one is sort of categories of, because people think about, you know, we talk about innovation and creativity, imagine, I'm going to create a new effect or method. That's all under sort of performance to me. But the, to me, there's also it's a six P's, you know, there's presentation, there is, how are we going to profit from it? We can innovate. There's been enormous innovation in that, making money in magic. How are we going to promote? Yeah. And then performance is number one. So I was starting to think beyond that. There's like five other dimensions besides just
five
performance,
P's,
methods, and effects.
Yeah.
And so that's also in there. And so rolling that die, you could think about how do we practice better? So one of the things I did another set and rolled, and how do we practice better in terms of magicians practicing? And one of the things that you see comedians do, I like to borrow from other fields. So I talk to technologists all the time about how do magicians create magic tricks. And I tell the story about, you know, being in the creativity room of a Copperfield or a Lance Burton or whatever. They have a team that is creating magic, and it's not magical.
Like
it's not like
room.
Being at Hogwarts. Yeah. And so I've been in the writer's room at Saturday Night Live, you know, and when they write, what is it like? It's not funny, right? It's a rigorous process that professionals execute. Same thing with magic.
Yeah, like Steve Martin says, comedy's not funny, or not pretty.
Right. And so it's this rigorous challenge. It can be satisfying and educational, and you can grow from it, but it's not necessarily the first order thing that people think of. And so I say innovation is a rigorous process that we follow. It's not waiting for the clouds to part and Gandhi to come to you in a Greek dream and tell you, you know, the revelation. That's what some people think. No, it's just work.
Yeah.
You know, it's a, having a lot of crap. Like the people have come up to me and said, Mark, I just need to have five great ideas and I'll have a career like yours. You know, and they're done like my five hit products across three companies and building new markets. And I'm like, yeah, but those came out of 4,000 really, really bad ideas.
Yeah, you failed in others.
Right. Mm-hmm. And those were failed ideas. They were elements of failed ideas that were then recombined into new things and continued to be polished and twisted until they clicked together like a Rubik's Cube in a new way that became the thing that worked.
Right.
And so it's a process of doing that. So I don't know the easy way of just to have the final idea. Even like a company like Twitter started as an audio podcasting thing. And when those guys pitched it to me initially, I was like, I'm not interested, you know, because I've been one of the early investors. Don't, you know, because who would ever want that, right?
Right, right.
But it ends up that a startup, you know, a new idea is changing in flux. So you can't, that's why people like shows like Shark Tank are often, you know, and executives try to judge ideas on the napkin phase. That's like trying to pick your Olympic athletes in cribs in the nursery when they're just born. Like they need to grow up, you know, until and become viable before you actually put them through that gauntlet of judging to try to judge them. And so hopefully by the time ideas get to a Shark Tank show, they've been filtered. But when they're nascent new ideas, you need to kind of protect them and develop a sense for and it's not like, oh, I love, there's other innovators that I love every one of my ideas and they chase a bunch of bad ideas. And you learn pretty quickly that you can't tell your bad ideas from your good ideas. So one of the things I teach is, like, you know, I have a little book I always carry with me and I teach people that. It's called the Bad Ideas Book. It's in the box. There is no good ideas book because all of my new ideas are bad ideas, except for the very few that I know are brilliant. And those are definitely bad ideas. Never work. And so all of my ideas are bad, and I always have my little notebook with me. I write them down without judging them, because as soon as you start judging them, you think it's not worth writing down, and then you don't end up with the thought that leads to the thought that leads to the thought that then leads to the right thing that was one element of an ultimate answer that builds a $100 million business. And so,
but it's important to write those ideas down.
Yes, or you never get the first thought that leads to the
exactly.
next thought.
Exactly.
And so, anyway, I launch this process. I walk people through one example of how we roll the dice, flip the coin, and I guess the gift shop had to restock the dice and cards.
Because they went, why all
there
of a sudden
was a run on
rush.
The dice and cards. You know, and I just went in there like at 1 a.m. and like bought some dice and card, you know, like, that's oh, here fun. We go. And labeled some coins I already had. But you can make your own set just by following the guide. So I asked people in the audience to take a photo of the three slides and cut up some Post-it notes or stickers or labels if you have them, and make your own set. And so that drives the randomization function, but it also drives constraints. So in other words, you have a problem or a space you're thinking about, and then these things are constraints. You have to now change from something that's the way it is to something old or to something new, or you have to make it bigger or you have to make it smaller. And those constraints actually drive creativity and enable it. Because some people think, well, the best creative ideas will come if you have no constraints. That is one exercise, but a better exercise is to actually put in arbitrary constraints. In fact, they have those contests like the weekend filmmaking, like they have 48 hours, you know, to make an entire short film.
We have one of those in Houston.
Yes, and they come up with amazingly creative things. But one of the things they found, and this was, they stumbled into it, because in order to make sure people didn't pre-have their ideas or pre-make their movie, which would be cheating and it'd be very hard to catch that, they, on the night that the 48 hours starts, they introduce, you make a movie, it's up to this long, and it has to have a woman in a raincoat, a cow, and some, you know, a third thing.
Some random
in it.
Thing, right.
And it just has to be somewhere in it. Doesn't have to be a central element. Can be, but doesn't have to be. And they started getting much more creative output. Instead of less, you would think, oh, it's going to be less creative because now they have to work that in. But actually,
but
somehow,
when you're under fire, it seems like you are a lot more creative.
Yeah, it's not just under fire of time pressure. That's one way to drive. And I also ideate. I teach people to ideate under a timer. And also, I teach people stop brainstorming, work alone, write down all of your ideas, define the problem, give it to separate people that you would have brainstormed with, and have them write down theirs, and then come together when they're already written down and you have to share what was on your written list, no matter what anybody else says. And that works way better than brainstorming.
Well, it's interesting. You know, Chris Funken mentioned earlier when he was on stage over there about when he was working a cruise ship, and the suitcases got lost, and he had to create his own show, and he got standing ovation, and he now has that as part of his solid regular show.
Some of the best magic I ever did was, you know, I kind of got into improv, which was basically I have no props, and I would ask the people in the audience in a close-up situation sitting at a poker table, and you know, that I'm sitting at, like, empty your pockets onto the table.
Yeah.
Of anything you're willing to bring out of your pockets in front of other people. And, you know, end up with a keychain, a pen, a comb, you know, lipstick, whatever. And I would have to do a magic show, do an hour of magic out of what was in their pockets. And that was some of the best stuff, right? And so that was like, to me, when I heard him say that, I was like, yep, that makes total sense to me. That's a great constraint. So sometimes having different ways of putting constraints in. So that's part of sort of this process. And my thought, I had a lot of great reaction from people and very thoughtful reaction. And when people come up to me and say how neat that was as an idea, I said, well, the thing to take from it is to judge it, like, is the idea of having a rigorous framework to help drive creativity helpful? Because the actual individual elements, what I suggested that you label the cards or each side of the dice or the coins, please change that, right? And that's also true in Kickbox. Like, you know, change and adapt that and share it back, because, and adapt it to you. Because there's, like, under the hearts, you know, there's 13 performers that I think are seminal and might have different styles or whatever, but you will have different.
You have different, exactly.
And so I mentioned, you know, fill in your own there. And, you know, I filled out 13 just so people could see what I was talking about. But make your own creativity kit that's a little different that applies to you. And then use that as a sort of seed, and then so that gives you randomization, it gives you constraints, and then there's the last element I talked about, which is collaboration. At a conference like this, now online communities that are out there, Magic Cafe, Magic on
Genie
Reddit,
Forum.
Genie Forum, you know, all of these places, and they are fantastic places to connect with people. You know, when I was a kid, I didn't know any other magicians. And, you know, to me, going to the Magic Castle and getting accepted into the juniors was like going to Hogwarts in some ways, because I just didn't know any other magicians, you know. And particularly, you know, sort of serious magicians who are trying to study the craft, and people that understood and talked about theory and not, you know, hippity-hop bunnies, you know, and SpongeBalls exclusively, although there's some great SpongeBall magic. It was more people that are trying to do interesting, creative, and expressive things with it. And so that was the side of magic I really love, that creativity. And the side that I've continued, I still think of magic tricks. And a friend of mine reminded me, who's here at the conference the other day, because Marco Tempest was on the same bill with me, and I had not met him before. And so we had a great talk backstage about the drones and things that he showed, and a lot of fun. But I've seen some of his YouTube videos with the iPad and all of that.
Amazing stuff.
And some of the great apps that Greg Rustami has done. And in 2007, I was at, you know, at the launch of the iPhone when it came out, and Steve Jobs announced it on stage and everything. And a few weeks after that, I was thinking about, we could do a lot of magic with the iPhone. And I made a list of 12 effects. Right.
Almost, like, immediately it came out, and you've got some ideas.
My friend reminded me, like, I pulled up that list it was an email that I had sent a friend, and he's like, and 10 of those have shipped as products. You know, it was like, you know, it has a motion sensor, so depending upon which way you turn over the phone, you could have a prediction come out.
Yeah.
It has the light sensor. You know, I just made a list, and here are all the methods, and here's the effects you could match them with. I never did any of them, but I just have them in a notebook, and I happened to write an email because a friend of mine was a magician, and he worked at Apple as a technologist, and I was like, oh, yeah, this is a fun thing. And I had forgotten that I had done that. But it's like, you know, there are a lot of things remaining to be discovered, and a lot of magic to be made happen. Now people's phones come out of their pockets. So the interesting thing is, what kind of magic can we do with their phone when it's ungaffed? And so one of the ideas I came up with that tool set was a illusion that I wanted to mock up, but we decided to talk about the black art thing. But the because Stan wanted to focus not so much on the effect or the use of the system, but to talk about the system.
Okay.
And so what I did was I threw down the coin, and I ended up with technology. And I was take something small and make something big and make it small.
Okay.
And so I was thinking about the great stage illusions, like Zigzag, Harbin's Zigzag, you know, classic. The red and yellow is still imprinted in my mind as an image, you know. And could we do a zigzag close-up? And I know people have done the beer can. Tenyo had the cigarette thing, right. And done lots of interesting stuff. But I was trying to think about, because one of the other challenges that came was, how do we make something more personal, more connected? And one of the things that always frustrated me about big box magic is it's kind of a puzzle to figure out, where did the tiger come from? Where did the girl go? But in a sense, in some ways, it's not as magical. It's a different kind of magical. And then close-up that happens right in front of you where you're very connected to it. So I always used to say, as a close-up guy, throwing, basically shade on the box guys on the stage, because there's all these fraternal, rivalry, I'd say, too bad that you can't put one of the audience members in the box. Like in the Harry Potter movies, they become a cat, and they know what it's like to look through a cat's eyes and come back out. And so I was starting to say, how do we personalize that? And I remembered that sort of joking criticism that I had offered in the past. And I said, well, how could we do that in close-up? So I thought about, what's the most personal object somebody has? It's their mobile phone. They spend an enormous amount of time on it.
Exactly.
So then I thought, could we do a zigzag? Has anyone done a zigzag with a mobile phone?
Nothing
Nobody
I've
must
seen.
Have.
No, I've seen it with an iPad.
Right. So, but my thought was... people in the audience, in a close-up audience, husband and wife or something, it's like, or even they don't know each other. Okay, you two, pull out your iPhones, FaceTime call him or her.
Okay.
And they now establish a call between their two phones.
All right.
And give me your phone while the call is live.
Okay, so you have both phones.
No, they keep one. The audience, I never touch one phone. They hand the other phone to me, and I now have a small apparatus just as large as the phone, and then slide it into it, close the door over it, and it's exactly zigzag. Open three doors.
Okay.
You can see the live screen, and now the person in the audience, we're looking at their face and their nose and their eyes. They're moving the phone around. I'm moving my phone in front of my face here.
Yeah.
And you would be picture seeing on the other phone before I close the door.
Right.
Their eye, their face, it's always in
motion.
So
you know it's not a video.
You know it's not a recording, certainly.
Right, recording. Mm-hmm.
It's a live video, and they're handing it. Imagine people handing it around the audience.
Yeah.
You are that phone now. You're connected.
Wow.
And they're seeing the view on their view from the box.
From the stage on that little thing. Yeah, the box.
Close the door, slide the middle out,
right.
And then open the door, and you see the screen. And they move it, and then on that part of the screen, they see their blinking eye,
Right.
In that part of the screen... You just put the person in the zigzag box.
Okay.
And I would have never come up with that without those dice and whatever. I'll never make it. So if somebody wants to make it, you can have that idea for free. Just send me one.
There you go.
It's the only price.
Kind of like a PDF idea. Yeah.
Yes, there you go. Just send it to me. Make it and send it to me.
Yeah.
And so I actually worked out a method how to do it. It's not easy, but I worked out at least an initial method. And so one of the ideas for the talk was I was going to lay that on people and say, by the end of the conference, we'll give a prize to the person that comes up with the best method. And so Stan's idea, which is, Mark, don't give them your method. Just tell them isn't that much.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll do the same here. Since I didn't get to do it at the conference, just due to time, we had to edit and curate. Somebody comes up with, I'd love to hear other methods. Email me at mark@kickbox.org.
Mark@kickbox.org?
Yeah.
Okay.
K-I-C-K-O-R, kickbox, K-I-C-K-B-O-X.org, and just M-A-R-K there.
Okay.
And people can, send me the idea. But I think it's a cool thing. I'm not a builder of effects. I'll lose a finger in a wood shop. So, but I think that I was already kind of going to make it like in 3D, my method, just to see in SketchUp, if it would work. But there's a lot of ways you could do it. You could think about the method mechanically. There's an extra now requirement of having the live phone, but boy, would that be really good. And then I thought of that just from rolling the dice and being forced into that constraint. And thinking about that old effect, and then how do I personalize it, and how do I,
make it new.
It posed the right question. Sometimes the right question is just a randomized question. And sometimes it leads you, by the way, it's not a panacea, sometimes it leads you into a complete, that was a blind alley, That was bizarre, but you didn't go anywhere. And then other times you end up like, I would have never gotten here.
Yeah, consider it a maze.
So I'd never know about the super black paint, or I would have never thought about, how do I put somebody in the box, or any of that. And so that to me was since just last night I was watching a performance and sitting there and I thought up a variation on that effect, which is wow, there's another cool way you could do
that. On the zigzag phone, you mean?
Yeah, without doing zigzag, but doing the connected phone in a close-up thing while the call is live right. in close-up, and you know, and it was basically like they were talking about things that go bump in the night, which is a great illusion that I, you know, they were talking about Leroy coming up with that illusion. I saw Henning do it live. And when I was a kid, and I was thinking like sort of a close-up version of things that go bump in the night, and one, the things are three phones.
Three phones. Huh. Okay.
And so anyway, it's sort of like a transposition.
Okay.
So I kind of worked out a way to do that. And I was like, an effect and even a method. I'm like, and it was a lot easier method than doing the zigzag. But it's like, so those ideas then propagate. And so I think that's part of the fun of having a framework that then drives you into those interesting questions with the constraints. And then, you know, collaborating with other people, because I find like chatting with people that, you know, kind of throw out interesting ideas because they other people have different experiences than you. And so I really think constraints, collaboration, and randomization are great tools. And that's what really TrickBox, sort of the idea of using some randomization and tools like that to drive those constraints is. And I laid that out, and so far people have responded. But, you know, the big message is think about using frameworks like this to structure and create. First of all, consider creating magic instead of just buying it. I think that buying it is great, and you should support the dealers in the community, or we won't have dealers in the community, but and certainly book authors. But also remix, first of all. You don't have to create. You can remix and combine moves and change, like, there's been a million songs, but there's only 12 notes. You know?
Good point. Good
and
point.
And so it's remixing and combining. Learn the basics of the masters. Like, you know, in jazz, they say you're not going to improvise until you learn how to play other people's music. So, yes, perform other people's magic. But then on the way, start branching out once you know why things work. And to me, that gets into the whole thing about sort of perception and reality and human perception, which was the speaker that followed me. A wonderful professor from Japan. I don't want to mangle his name, but he you know, showed those optical illusions that he came up with by reverse engineering how the human visual system works to design perfect.
Right.
So he started is another perfect example of starting with the effect and working backwards to get to the method, the object.
Yeah.
And so he literally like used neurology to study how the visual system works, and then develop mathematical formulas and topologies to model those things as to how they would look from a human eye, and then used computers to model them and 3D printers to print them, and then came up with perfect optical illusions, better than any artist drawn optical illusions.
Yeah,
mind-blowing. And that's exactly, you know, what he did for optical illusions, what we need to do to develop magic tricks, and what technologists need to do to develop products, and entrepreneurs to develop products that delight customers. And that's, you know, should be our goal. And so I think that's the interesting connection and intersection. And so when we kind of figured that out, I could maybe come and talk about that. That might be of relevance to the magic audience.
Definitely was.
And so I got that response and some interesting, thoughtful ideas of how to change the framework already. I'm like, oh, that's great. Yeah. Try it out and let me know.
Right.
You know, because I have no ownership over it. And it's more like whatever works for you. Some people come up to me like, well, you know, we use Kickbox at Amazon, but we changed it, you know. I'm like, great, you know, like, please.
Don't
one
worry.
Thing
I, that's why I
encourage
I
had other people, I'd like, you know, Ford Motor Company come to me and say, why don't you Kickbox just like you do it at Adobe? And I'm like, no, please don't, you know, like, take this and make it your own, like much what we say in magic. Don't, you know, you might be inspired by Goshman. Please don't do magic where half dollars appear under salt shakers, you know.
Right. The same with patter. Don't steal someone else's jokes and things like
that. Well, you're not them.
That's right. You can only be you.
Right, be you.
But going back to something there just a moment ago that we were talking about artists and everything, I was thinking about the classic artists that years ago that there would be a Michelangelo, whomever, that there would be, as they were learning, they would actually copy the masterpieces of the masters to develop their own style, because eventually it's like, okay, you've copied that enough. And so I don't want to discourage people from copying initially, but don't plan on being a success until you have found your your originality, you know.
That's a great observation, talking about the painting masters. You know, another good analogy is to, you know, if you want to design airplanes as a career, never flying in someone else's airplane is probably a bad idea, and only flying in ones you design.
If you have it, yeah.
Yes, if you've never. I designed my first airplane. Want to go for a ride?
Let me think about that. No.
And so definitely you'll learn, but you also learn what works. Right. But the neat thing is that people that invent great magic often don't perform it. Just like many of the people that write the best songs don't sing. And certainly there are no screenwriters I know that would stoop to being actors.
like Tarantino or anybody.
Yeah, well, there's a few. There's a few yeah. that do. But the, you know, it's like magical creators, it's its own thing. Mm-hmm. And I don't just mean people in a wood shop, you know, making things.
Right.
It's creators of concepts and ideas and recombining those ideas. I haven't written code in 30 years in software, but I created tons of software products that, you know, I immediately found there are people who engineer much better than I do.
Mm-hmm.
And Copperfield found there are people who make illusions much better than I do.
Sure,
but
farm
he
it
brings
out.
That process.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even think he farms it in the sense that he's intimately, and every creator I know is intimately involved in the process, but they also are good enough. Like, composers don't need to play every instrument in the orchestra. Composer brings the orchestra together with the unifying vision and message.
Good.
And a Copperfield doesn't need to be a violinist, you know, to compose the music and bring the orchestra together and give them the reason to play and the structure to play in. And so that is, you're leading a group creative process in the creation of any of those things. And certainly in creating a talk like mine, friends of mine, both on the technology side and the magic side, because even though I don't do magic, I've maintained lots of magical friends.
Sure.
And I enjoy, you know, seeing magic. And so for me, that, you know, that's why it's great to be here at a magic conference. You know, I've gone to almost none in a long, long, long time.
Yeah, long
and
time.
This one is a great one. And so I'm having a great time kind of connecting. And I'm seeing people I haven't seen in 30 years.
And making new connections.
Yeah, and making new connections with people. And it's great how I was worried that the audience wouldn't be very receptive, you know, like to a... It's like, hey, I'm doing the opening keynote at a magic conference, and I'm not doing any magic. You know, it's like that's scary. And
well, that's what makes this conference unique from others, I believe, as well.
Well, I think some of the best talks, you know, somebody came to me and said the best talks are, you know, have been a mathematician, a storyteller, and you know, it's like from some they didn't do any magic,
right,
you know,
right.
And but they have relevant things to say about magic, and that's why every art informs other arts, which is why in inventing technology we pull from the worlds of classic art, from the worlds of like. Creatives bring inspiration from other fields and integrate them.
Sure, sure.
And so that's another great theory.
Well, listen, thank you very much for your time. And before we close, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word. So I always like to ask my guests, what is it that's your philosophy of life? What is it you live by? I mean, what is, you know, charges you to wake up in the morning? You know, it doesn't have to be a word. It could be a phrase, you know, just something you live by. Or could change from day to day.
It does.
What is it today?
I have to think about that for a second. It's hard to sum things up, but I think, you know, particularly for your audience, it's, you know, it's focus on effects, not methods, and focus on process over performance. And what I mean by that is processes are systems.
Right, I understand.
And so it's a great performance is the result of a very long process of evolution,
good
practice,
point.
Training, rehearsal, and it's the rigorous process by which you do that. You can have a bad night, but the consistently great performances come from people, you know, that elevate to that level incrementally over time because they execute a rigorous process. So think about process more than just one magical performance.
Good advice. Good advice. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. So for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Mark Randall, and this is Scotty Young. Well, I don't know about you, but I thought that was just tremendous. There were so many gems that he dropped in there for us, and it's worth going back and hearing again and again and again. I want to remind you to go to themagicwordpodcast.com where you will find those photos that I had taken during his talk that show the words that you can put on the sticky notes onto the dice and the coins and the cards, and that way you can randomize your own ideas to come up with something really creative, really pretty cool stuff. Well, I have, as I mentioned, a lot of things kind of in queue right now that I'm going to be letting go over the next few weeks, and the best way to try to figure out or to know who's going to be up from week to week is to subscribe to our weekly pod letter, and whenever that you go to themagicwordpodcast.com, there should be a pop-up screen there that will allow you to join that free weekly newsletter. It's very brief. I just tell you who it is that's coming on this week, who will be up next week, and also a suggestion from the archives of someone that you might have missed from the past that it's worth going back and having a second listen. So with an archive of over 500 episodes, there are a lot of really great ones that you should go back and hear again if you haven't heard the first time. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember to think about the process over performance. This is Scotty out.